great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is The Fog of War, from the audio section of the movie Fog of War, which features the life of former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. He served under President Kennedy and Johnson. He reflects on his part in the bombing of Tokyo, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Vietnam War. This film could have been titled The Evil That Men Do, but that's already taken. He talks about war crimes he and others committed. He observes the failures of government officials at the highest level to understand the basis of wars they direct.
Let me hear your voice level to make sure it's the same.
Okay, how's my voice
level? That's fine.
Terrific.
Now, I remember exactly the sentence I left off on. I remember how it started, and it was cut off in the middle, but you can fix it up some way. I don't want to go back and introduce the sentence because I know exactly what I wanted to say.
Go ahead.
Okay. Any military commander who is honest with himself or with those he's speaking to will admit that he has made mistakes in the application of military power. He's killed people, unnecessarily, his own troops or other troops, through mistakes, through errors of judgment. 100 or thousands or tens of thousands, maybe even 100,000. But he hasn't destroyed nations. And the conventional wisdom is, don't make the same mistake twice. Learn from your mistakes. And we all do. Maybe we make the same mistake three times, but hopefully not four or five. There'll be no learning period with nuclear weapons. You make one mistake, you're going to destroy nations. In my life, I've been part of wars. 3 years in the U.S. Army during World War II. 7 years as Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. 13 years at the World Bank, across the world. At my age, 85, I'm at an age where I can look back and derive some conclusions about my actions. My rule has been, try to learn. Try to understand what happened. Develop the lessons and pass them on.
This is the Secretary of Defense of the United States, Robert McNamara. His department absorbs 10% of the national income of this country and over half of every tax dollar. His job has been called the toughest in Washington, and McNamara is the most controversial figure that has ever held the job. Walter Lippmann calls him not only the best Secretary of Defense, but the first one who ever asserted civilian control over the military. His critics call him a con man, an IBM machine with legs, an arrogant dictator.
Secretary, I've noticed in several cabinet offices that little silver calendar thing there. Can you explain that?
Yes, this was given by President Kennedy. On the calendar are engraved the dates October 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, and finally 28 were the dates when we literally looked down the gun barrel into nuclear war.
Thank you.
a cloak of deceit, the Soviet Union introduced nuclear missiles into Cuba, targeting 90 million Americans. The CIA said the warheads had not been delivered yet. They thought 20 were coming on a ship named the Poltava. We mobilized 180,000 troops. The first day's air attack was planned at 1080 sorties, a huge air attack. Kennedy was trying to keep us out of war. I was trying to help him keep us out of war. And General Curtis LeMay, whom I served under, as a matter of fact, in World War II, was saying, let's go in, let's totally destroy Cuba. On that critical Saturday, October 27th, we had two Khrushchev messages in front of us. One had come in Friday night, and it had been dictated by a man who was either drunk or under tremendous stress. Basically, he said, if you'll guarantee you won't invade Cuba, we'll take the missiles out. Then, before we could respond, we had a second message that had been dictated by a bunch of hardliners. And it said, in effect, if you attack, we're prepared to confront you with masses of military power. So what to do? We had this, I'll call it the soft message and the hard message. At the elbow of President Kennedy was Tommy Thompson, former U.S. ambassador to Moscow. He and Jane, his wife, had literally lived with Khrushchev and his wife upon occasion. Tommy Thompson said, Mr. President, I urge you to respond to the soft message. The president said to Tommy, we can't do that. It'll get us nowhere. Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
We're not going to get these weapons out of Cuba probably anyway. By negotiation. Now, Kennedy, you're going to have to agree with
the president. I think there's still a chance.
Get back down.
The important thing for Khrushchev seems to be able to say, I invade Cuba, I stop the invasion.
In Thompson's mind was this thought. Khrushchev's gotten himself in a hell of a fix. He would then think to himself, my God, if I can get out of this with a deal that I can say to the Russian people, Kennedy was going to destroy Castro and I prevented it. Thompson, knowing Khrushchev as he did, thought, Khrushchev will accept that. And Thompson was right. That's what I call empathy. We must try to put ourselves inside their skin and look at us through their eyes just to understand the thoughts that lie behind their decisions and their actions. Khrushchev's advisors were saying, there can be no deal unless you somewhat reduce the pressure on us when you ask us to reduce the pressure on you.
We had attempted to invade Cuba.
Well, with the Bay of Pigs, that undoubtedly influenced their thinking. I think that's correct. But more importantly, from a Cuban and a Russian point of view, they knew what, in a sense, I really didn't know. We had attempted to assassinate Castro under Eisenhower and under Kennedy and later under Johnson. And in addition to that, major voices in the U.S. were calling for invasion. In the first message, Khrushchev said this: "We and you ought not pull on the ends of a rope which you have tied the knots of war. Because the more the two of us pull, the tighter the knot will be tied. And then it will be necessary to cut that knot. And what that would mean is not for me to explain to you. I have participated in two wars and know that war ends when it has rolled through cities and villages, everywhere sowing death and destruction. For such is the logic of war. If people do not display wisdom, they will clash like blind moles, and then mutual annihilation will commence." I want to say, and this is very important, at the end, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. We came that close to nuclear war at the end. Rational individuals. Kennedy was rational. Khrushchev was rational. Castro was rational. Rational individuals came that close to total destruction of their societies. And that danger exists today. Major lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis is this: the indefinite combination of human fallibility and nuclear weapons will destroy nations. Is it right and proper that today there are 7,500 strategic offensive nuclear warheads, of which 2,500 are in 15-minute alert to be launched by the decision of one human being? It wasn't until January 1992, in a meeting chaired by Castro in Havana, Cuba, that I learned 162 nuclear warheads, including 90 tactical warheads, were on the island at the time of this critical moment of the crisis. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And Castro got very angry with me because I said, "Mr. President, let's stop this meeting. This is totally new to me. I'm not sure I got the translation right. Mr. President, I have three questions to you. Number one, did you know the nuclear warheads were there? Number two, if you did, would you have recommended to Khrushchev, in the face of a U.S. attack, that he used them? Number three, if he had used them, what would have happened to Cuba?" He said, "Number one, I knew they were there. Number two, I would not have recommended to Khrushchev. I did recommend to Khrushchev that they be used. Number three, what would have happened to Cuba? It would have been totally destroyed." That's how close we were.
And he was willing to accept that?
Yes. Oh, and he went on to say, "Mr. McNamara, if you and President Kennedy had been in a similar situation, that's what you would have done." I said, "Mr. President, I hope to God we would not have done it. Pull the temple down on our heads, my God." In a sense, we'd won. We got the missiles out without war. My deputy and I brought the five chiefs over. We sat down with Kennedy. And he said, "Gentlemen, we won. I don't know what you ever said, but you know we won. I know we won." And I said, "One hell, we lost. We should go in and wipe them out today." LeMay believed that ultimately we're going to confront these people in a conflict with nuclear weapons, and by God, We better do it when we have greater superiority than we will have in the future. At the time, we had a 17-1 strategic advantage in nuclear numbers. We'd done 10 times as many tests as they had. We were certain we could retain that advantage if we limited the tests. The chiefs were all opposed. They said the Soviets will cheat. Well, I said, how will they cheat? You won't believe this, but they said, they'll test them behind the moon. I said, you're out of your mind. That's absurd. It's almost impossible for our people today to put themselves back into that period. In my 7 years as secretary, we came within a hair's breadth of war with the Soviet Union on three different occasions. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, for 7 years as Secretary of Defense, I lived the Cold War. During the Kennedy administration, they designed a 100 megaton bomb. It was tested in the atmosphere. I remember this. Cold War? Hell, it was a hot war. I think the human race needs to think more about killing, about conflict. Is that what we want in this 21st century? Memory is of a city exploding with joy. It was November 11, 1918. I was 2 years old. You may not believe that I have the memory, but I do. I remember the tops of the streetcars being crowded with human beings cheering and kissing and screaming into World War I. We'd won. But also celebrating the belief of many Americans, particularly Woodrow Wilson, we'd fought a war to end all wars. His dream was that the world could avoid great wars in the future. Disputes among great nations would be resolved. I also remember that I wasn't allowed to go outdoors to play with my friends without wearing a mask. It was an ungodly flu epidemic. Large numbers of Americans were dying, 600,000, and millions across the world. My class in the first grade was housed in a shack, a wooden shack. But we had an absolutely superb teacher. And this teacher gave a test to the class every month. And she reseated the class based on the results of that test. And there were vertical rows. And she put the person with the highest grade in the first seat in the left-hand row. And I worked my tail off to be in that first seat. Now, the majority of the classmates were whites, Caucasians, so on, WASPs, if you will. But my competition for that first seat were Chinese, Japanese, and Jews. On Saturday and Sunday, I went and played with my classmates. They went to their ethnic schools. They learned their native language. They learned their culture, their history, and they came back determined on Monday to beat that damn Irishman. But they didn't do it very often.
One congressman called you, Mr. I Have All the Answers McNamara, and there's been suggestion from some congressmen that you come up there, in spite of the weight of their experience, prepared to give them simple little lessons in things. Is that your attitude?
No, perhaps they don't know how much I don't know, and there's much indeed. I do make a serious effort prepare myself properly for these congressional discussions. I suppose I spend perhaps 100 or 120 hours in testifying before Congress each year, and each hour of testimony requires 3 to 4 hours of preparation.
What about the contention that your attitude is sometimes arrogant, that you never admit you were wrong? Have you ever been wrong, sir?
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm not going to tell you what I've been wrong. If you don't know, I'm not going to tell you, but Oh, on countless occasions.
I applied to Stanford University. I very much wanted to go, but I couldn't afford it. So I lived at home and I went to Berkeley. $52 a year tuition. I started Berkeley, the bottom of the Depression. 25 million males were unemployed. Out of that class of 3,500, three elected to Phi Beta Kappa at the end of the sophomore year. Of those three, one became a Rhodes Scholar. I went to Harvard. The third went to work for $65 a month and was damn happy to have the job. The society was on the verge of, I don't want to say revolution, although had Roosevelt not done some of the things he did, it could have become far more violent. In any event, that was what I was thrown into. I never heard of Plato and Aristotle before I became a freshman at Berkeley. And I remember the professor, Loewenberg, the freshman philosophy professor, I couldn't wait to go to another class. I took more philosophy courses, particularly one in logic and one in ethics. Stress on values. Something beyond oneself. And a responsibility to society. After graduating the University of California, I went to Harvard Graduate School of Business for 2 years. And then I went back to San Francisco. I began to court this young lady that I'd met when we were 17 in our first week at Berkeley, Margaret Craig. And I was making some progress after 8 or 9 months. I proposed, and she accepted. She went with her aunt and her mother on a trip across the country. She telegraphed me, "Must order engraved invitations to include your middle name. What is it?" And I wired back, "My middle name is Strange." And she said, "I know it's strange, but what is it?" Well, I mean, it is strange. It's Robert Strange Factor. And it was a marriage made in heaven. At the end of a year, we had our first child. The delivery costs were $100, and we paid that $10 a month. Those were some of the happiest days of our lives. And then the war came. I'd been promoted to assistant professor. I was the youngest assistant professor at Harvard. And to a salary, by the way, of $4,000 a year. Harvard Business School's market was drying up. The males were being drafted or volunteering. So the dean, being farsighted, brought back a government contract to establish an officer candidate school for what was called statistical control in the Air Force. We said to the Air Force, "Look, we're not going to take anybody you send up here. We're going to select the people. You have a punch card for every human being brought into the Air Corps. We're going to run those punch cards through the IBM sorting machines, and we're going to sort on age, education, accomplishment, grades, etc." We were looking for the best of the brightest, the best brains, the greatest capacity to lead, the best judgment. U.S. was just beginning to bomb. We were bombing by daylight. The loss rate was very, very high. So they commissioned a study. And what did we find? We found the abort rate was 20%. 20% of the planes that took off from England to bomb targets in Germany turned around before they got to the target. Well, that was a hell of a mess. We lost 20% of our capability right there. A form, I think it was called Form 1A or something like that, was a mission report. And if you aborted a mission, you had to write down why. So we get all these things and we analyze them. And we finally concluded it was baloney. They were aborting out of fear because the loss rate was 4% per sortie. The combat tour was 25 sorties. Didn't mean 100% were going to be killed, but a hell of a lot of were going to be killed. They knew that, and they found reasons to not go over the target. So we reported this. One of the commanders was Curtis LeMay, colonel in command of a B-24 group. He was the finest combat commander of any service I came across in the war, but he was extraordinarily belligerent. Many thought brutal. He got the report. He issued an order. He said, I will be in the lead plane on every mission. Any plane that takes off will go over the target or the crew will be court-martialed. The abort rate dropped overnight. Now that's the kind of a commander he was.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, on this Christmas Eve, there are over 10 million men in the armed forces of the United States alone. 1 year ago, 1,700,000 were serving overseas. By next July 1st, that number will rise to over 5 million. Plenty of bad news for the Japs in the not too far distant future.
Houston, we have a problem.
And now for something completely different.